This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, we head with Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse, experience the Mexico City of the 1970s in Roma, and get a heavy dose of swear words and sex just in time for the holidays in The Favorite. But we're going to get things started by talking about Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse, definitely one of the most pleasant surprises of the year, and legitimately one of the best films of the year, as far as I'm concerned. This film really sort of took us by storm in this, period in time in the film industry where superheroes are everywhere. This is, safe to say, a very unique take on one with some insanely crazy visuals and some really clear tongue-in-cheek humor that just inherently works. Now, for those of you who know me, I'm a Spider-Man freak, so this film is definitely sort of preaching to the choir, but I'm definitely appreciative of, the wide audience that a film like this is reaching, and it's definitely well worth it in that case. Like I was alluding to, I've never seen animation quite like this. This is certainly a very unique animation style that is just so engaging. It almost feels like an acid trip at certain points, and obviously they're playing with sort of dimensional travel, so it sort of lends itself naturally to that. But the film is not only just really incredibly engaging, but it takes full advantage of the source material's comic book roots. Not only are the visuals just really brightly colored and really stand out on the screen, but they even use, comic book panels and just really inventive ways of storytelling that isn't sort of possible in the live action superhero format. I mean, obviously the film has an incredible voice cast. Shameik Moore, who I was a big fan of in the film Dope, is really great as Miles Morales. Finally, Miles Morales is coming sort of to the big screen for the first time. Obviously, it's been a long time coming. People have been, really hoping that he would, as this is a character. This is sort of a version of Spider-Man that really became popular in the last decade or so, at least achieved its height of popularity. And it's really refreshing just to see a Spider-Man story told from a completely different perspective. And one of the things what's interesting is that, one of the things I was concerned about heading into this film, at least based on the trailers, was, they cast Jake Johnson as Peter Parker, but man, does it work in context of the film. It's sort of the perfect choice, and it makes complete sense why they would cast him in this role. But they do a really fun job where Chris Pine even plays a version of Spider-Man, but Jake Johnson plays this essentially schlubby Peter Parker who is divorced from MJ, and he's just clearly, I just like it that we're seeing a version of Spider-Man, the character that we haven't seen before. Just a schlubby sort of, he can, and what's so ironic about the film that I like is that he's this sort of mentor figure, to Miles, and it's like, Jake Johnson's version of Peter Parker, he's still good at the superhero thing, despite the fact that he clearly doesn't care that much and isn't nearly as invested as he used to be. But it's just that dynamic in particular, I think, is just one of the most really enjoyable parts of the film.
It's really hard to pin down what is the most enjoyable part of this film, because it is just such a joy from start to finish. There's not a single frame that's wasted in this. And I'm just I'll start with the animation, because I'm just blown away by the visual style of this. Like you said, the medium of animation kind of allows you to do things that you wouldn't be able to do with the live action universe. And that could be, good or bad, depending on the filmmaker. But here, I think they really hype up the style of it. And, as they delve deeper into the Spider-Verse and you meet more versions of Spider-Man, it really pays off. I mean, later on in the film, this isn't a spoiler, it's in the trailer, and you've probably seen, that they have like five different Spider-Man show up towards the end. In the middle. But I want to start with Nicolas Cage's Spider-Man Noir, which is probably my favorite character in the film, at least from a comedic standpoint. It's basically this hard-nosed detective with these gritty one-liners, like, do you light a match and just let it burn so you can feel something? And just, that tongue-in-cheek style. And you have John Mulaney as Spider-Ham, which is like a Porky Pig, smart mouth thing. And then Haley Steinfeld is, I don't want to get too far into that character, but she shows up as a version of Spider-Man as well. I guess what's most important about this film is that they give Miles Morales a reason to be Spider-Man. And, he always has this back and forth with his father, and his father's always telling him that he believes in him, and, he expects better of him, and he sees a spark in him. And that's a really, galvanizing thing to see with this character. In the best moments of the Spider-Man franchise, you see that, that will for Peter Parker to want to do good in the universe. And when it hits Miles Morales, and when he finally kind of comes into his own as Spider-Man, it's really, you get choked up watching it. It's just so, you want to just, stand up and cheer and pump your fist in the air. And it's just absolutely so incredible. And I'm so heartened to see that there are, you know, the filmmakers that I, you know, love dearly, such as Barry Jenkins, on Twitter, just like freaking out about how good this movie is. It really is that good. It's super entertaining. It's funny. It's heartfelt. It's twisty and turny. It doesn't dumb anything down. There's a really coherent plot to this. And there are some really good twists in it that kind of caught me off guard. There's a little bit of a gender bending of characters that have showed up in Spider-Man before that I think works really well. I don't want to give anything away, but let's just say Catherine Hahn does not go to waste. This is a fantastic movie. For me, it is runaway the best animated film of the year, and like you said, one of the best films of the year, period.
For sure. And I think what's so great about it, I mean, obviously we've talked a lot about the cast, but there's even like characters that they present in a completely different way. I loved this version of Aunt May, played by Lily Tomlin, which I think is a really great choice, where it's like, oh, you know, the way she's introduced, oh, it's classic Aunt May. And then you see there's much more going on here. And I think what's great about this film is just the concept of it, obviously, with all this interdimensional travel, it lends itself to that. And, you know, whereas, you know, we've had, you know, oh, if they were to make, you know, a live action Spider-Man and have Miles Morales, you know, there'd be freaking, you know, people out there, you know, outraged for no apparent reason. But I think what's great about this film is it's able to do it in a way where everyone can enjoy it and not have that takeaway. And I think that's what's so great about it, because we need these diverse perspectives, especially in a genre that has become so, you know, sort of the number one genre in the film industry at this point. And I think this film sort of completely succeeds at that, and it's able to take these characters that we know and love and sort of twist them on their head and present different versions of them. That's just very refreshing in that sense. I also liked how even in this film, you know, we get a Stan Lee cameo. I thought that was a really great, nice touch. But, you know, it's just a really fun movie. It has a really great sense of humor, and that's sort of punctuated with the post-credit sequence, which I think is really great. But, you know, I think what's great about this film, and it's one of the rare superhero films nowadays, obviously, you know, there's always going to be sequels to these very popular films, but one that I'm saying bring on all these different sequels, you know, because, you know, there's so many different possibilities, so many different characters you can follow, and all of them are interesting to their own degree. There's a lot of great setup for these characters, and they don't all, you know, have equal footing in the film, but you can see where, you know, following a story of one of these other characters might be really beneficial to us sort of as an audience. But overall, it's just a real blast. I am in complete agreement with you. Definitely one of the best animated, definitely the best animated film of the year, and absolutely one of my favorite films of the year. Obviously, you know, I'm a Spider-Man freak, but it was just so refreshing to see, you know, this variety in a Spider-Man story and get all these various different perspectives that you don't necessarily expect to find in a film like this. But just really fantastic film overall, and it definitely gets the highest recommendation, as I can see from both of us.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it would be great to see it. Obviously, I would watch a Spider-Man noir film. I would be there at midnight on the first screening of it. I would try to get preview passes if I could. But I would love to see more of Miles Morales, too, because I think it's just such an interesting universe they've set up for him. Obviously, we're used to seeing Peter Parker as, you know, the 30-year-old high school student that's, you know, saving the day and everything. But what's interesting about Miles Morales is that he actually feels like a kid. And, you know, even beyond that, you know, like you said, it's a very diverse cast. It's representation matters, representation matters, representation matters. And I think even just like building up the fact that, you know, he feels like a fish out of water, that he's in a charter school and he's really one of the only people of color in the school. It's just such an interesting setup. And it doesn't really affect his relationships with others within the schools, aside from being a fish out of water. But I would like to see that explored more in depth in subsequent films. And, you know, even in Spider-Man Homecoming, there was a little bit of a tease of certain characters from this particular iteration that could show up, maybe even in Far From Home later next summer, I think. Next July. But yeah, it's a fantastic movie, and I want to see more of Miles Morales. This is my first introduction to him. My context for Spider-Man only comes from the movies, because I just never had the attention span to read comic books. I wasn't really a big cartoon guy when I was a kid. I was always trying to punch above my weight, futilely so, maybe. This is just fantastic. This is the kind of movie that I would want my kid to see if I, you know, ever get the balls to have one. But that's neither here nor there. It's fantastic. For love of God, just go out and see it. I know that this is a busy time of year and there's just so much else out there, but don't, it would be doing a disservice to yourself to wait to see this and, you know, watch it on your phone phone or some crap when it comes out on Netflix or Amazon. This is something that, and that you will rarely hear me advocating, especially considering all the annoying kids that were in my screening. You will rarely hear me advocating that you need to go to the theater to see a movie immediately. This is certainly one of those, and for the reasons of just having all those visuals in your face, see it in an IMAX, see it in a Dolby Cinema, Showcase X Plus, Regal, whatever their premium is, whatever you can whatever you can do to see this on the big screen, it is wholeheartedly recommended. But with that in mind, I think we can turn our attention to more prestige fare, although that might be damning Spider-Man a little bit too much, because I do think it can punch at that same level as the next two films that we're talking about. But we're going to shift our attention to Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. Now, for those of you who took the time, and thank you very much in advance listening to our top 10 directors episode from over the summer, you'll know that I'm a big fan of Alfonso Cuarón. I thought Gravity was a little bit of a misstep from the perspective of the screenplay. Maybe Alfonso Cuarón, the screenwriter, is not quite as strong as Alfonso Cuarón, the filmmaker. But with Roma, I think the two kind of coalesce in a way that he really hasn't been able to do since Y Tu Mama Tambien, which is, that movie's almost 20 years old now. But this basically tells a story. It's a semi-autobiographical film about when he was growing up in an upper-middle-class family in Mexico City. And it takes a perspective of the maid, Cleo, who was more or less helping raise the kids. I mean, you know, for anyone who's come from means and has had a live-in nanny or a maid living in the house, you know that there's a special relationship that can develop between the family and this hired help. And I don't want to give too much away, because I think part of what makes this film so impactful is that the first half of the film is very methodical and just kind of laying everything out and really just taking you. There's almost no story in this film, but that's totally okay, because you're just following these characters in their day-to-day life and living with them and getting to know them, so that when things start to become more serious in the second half of the film, it just, oh my god, it knocks you over the head in a way that very few movies this year have been able to do. There's one scene, you know, I'm not even going to bother spoiling it, so let's just talk about the craft of the filmmaking here, because I feel this is Alfonso Cuarón's, and this is saying a lot, but I feel like this might actually be his masterpiece from a pure directing standpoint. He serves as his own director of photography on this too, and it's just brilliant how he packs each frame with so much information. I mean, the guy uses long takes better than anyone. No disrespect to PTA or Iñárritu or anyone else, but I think Cuarón knows how to do it, and you know, in a way that you don't even notice that it's happening. I mean, he just does like these stationary shots in which the camera pans. It doesn't move, it just pans around, and you follow these characters, and each frame is just so packed. And like I said, it really pays off towards the end, and it's just such a beautiful film. And I know that a lot of people, unfortunately, are going, I know Cuarón wanted people to see this on a big screen, and it's getting a release in limited markets. Most people are going to see this on Netflix, and I know someone was even joking on Twitter, you know, finally watching Roma the way Cuarón wanted to, when he was showing a picture of his Nintendo 3DS or something like that. But it's just, I have a very nice TV. I'm fortunate to have a nice TV. My dad let me use his Best Buy credit card, so I have one of the fancy OLED televisions. So there wasn't much lost in translation for me. Maybe size and scope, that's one thing. But this is just a stunning film. He captures, you know, the rural Mexican landscapes in a way that feel really immediate. He gives each character, I mean, and these are all unknown actors. Yalitza Aparicio, she's a brand new actress. She plays Cleo in this film, and she's very, very good. Very understated role, but it demands so much of her. And they're just, and it's hard to really discuss anything more about this film without spoiling it. And I really don't want to do that, because I think you owe it to yourself to let yourself be punched in the gut and to be choked out by tears by this film. This is brilliant filmmaking from top to bottom, and it's really good to see Alfonso Cuarón, at least for me, get back to what he does best.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think this may be my favorite Cuarón film. I've definitely always been a fan of his films, but I guess like some of them have always left me a bit cold, so he didn't ever raise into my absolute favorite filmmakers. But this film definitely puts him in that conversation. I was fortunate enough to get to see this film back at the back at TIFF in September with Corone in attendance among, as well as the cast, and getting to see it on the big screen. I will say, you know, I think the thing that's amazing about Corone, especially, you know, apart from, you know, obviously all these incredible long takes that he does, is that there's so much depth to simple shots. There's so much going on in the background. There are, like, you know, like in Rome, Mexico, there's different sequences where there's just so much going on, and there's so much depth, not just to the story and the layers of the characters, but to the visuals. And I think that's what was so striking. In fact, shockingly, at this film festival, I was sitting next to this this guy who felt the need, like, there was one image of a crab, which, you know, I'm sure is etched into most people's minds, but for some reason he thought this was a good idea to bring out his phone and take a picture of it. I don't know why I'm complaining about that when I should be talking about this incredible film, but I feel like I had to mention that because I was like, you're sitting in an audience watching an Alfonso Cuarón film, an incredible experience, and you see an amazing visual and your first instinct is to pull out your phone and take a picture of it. I don't know what is going through your head, buddy. But getting back to the, sorry, I had to do that, but getting back to the film itself, you know, and I feel like I'm almost a broken record on this because I feel like I've said this in subsequent episodes, but you know, what I like about this film is it's telling the story from a perspective that we don't normally see, sort of from the ground level, but it's clearly a story that Corone is emotionally attached to. Obviously, he's made it clear that there's a sort of, you know, a sort of a version of, you know, sort of his upbringing and sort of his mother's journey, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, or something to that effect. But, you know, it's really affecting, you know, classic Corone. There's amazing bookend shots to this film, you know, from the opening shot to the closing shot. Just really make you feel like you've experienced something in particular. But like you said, it's not really like one sort of clear storyline. But what I found really striking about the film is there's a lot set up early on in those, in that methodical layout that ends up paying off later on that you wouldn't normally expect in sort of a film that unfolds like this. But there's just so many set pieces without sort of getting into spoilers. There's like an extended sort of Christmas New Year's sequence, which I think is really brilliant, and the way it plays out was just like unexpected, but unbelievable. There's what I love about it as well as, you know, Corone has always been a visual filmmaker, and I think he does such a brilliant job, even though there isn't sort of one major storyline thread, although obviously we're following this housekeeper for most of it, you know, there are, you know, relationships that are conveyed almost completely through visuals over the course, like dissolution of certain relationships, which I thought was absolutely brilliant and just unbelievable, the way he's able to do that, and not many other filmmakers could, and I think he's able just to express that well. There's an incredible sequence near the end, sort of on the beach, where which is just like unbelievable, one of those sequences where it's just like you could tell the audience, like when I was watching it at the film festival, you could tell the audience was just invested and like even reacting with shock at certain moments, but it's just unbelievable. And it's just sort of like you said, the first half is sort of methodical, and then in the second half, safe to say, the film explodes in a bit more ways than one, and I think it's really effectively done, where it's all that build up and then it's just like almost the characters are thrown into chaos at certain points, and I think it just really works, and I can certainly see why this film is getting the praise it deserves. And while it may not be my number one on the year, it's definitely definitely one of the best films of the year without question.
It's up there. It's and you know, I think what the what's most miraculous about this is that it kind of takes place during this and I will freely admit to knowing nothing about Mexico's politics as far as the in-house stuff goes. I know, you know, U.S.-Mexico relations only from the context in which it affects our country, and that, you know, shame on me for that, for not knowing more about our neighbors to the south. But so the there's political turmoil, and there, you know, there are shots in the background of, you know, student protests, and the way that pays off and ties into the relationships between this housekeeper, Cleo, and her love interest Merle in the film pays off in such a way that it is an image that is etched into my brain and will probably haunt me for the rest of my miserable life. It is just terrifying in the way that you know, kind of continues this chain of events that goes in. The next scene in particular is even more harrowing, and then the scene after that is even more harrowing, and it just it's emotionally draining, but that's what I kind of look for in a movie. I want to be moved. I want to be, you know, told these stories. I want to hear everyone's story. I want to know what makes people tick. And I don't want to say that from, like, you know, this kind of perverse thing. I just want to get to know people. I think that learning the ins and outs of humanity makes us feel better about ourselves because we have that greater connection. And, you know, going back again to Spider-Man, the connection between the two is that representation matters. This was Mexico's entry for best foreign film at the Oscars, but it probably will get nominated for best picture. And even though Alfonso Cuarón, for all intents and purposes, despite being of Mexican origin, is pretty much an American filmmaker at this point, having worked in the studio system. But this is just kind of like a culmination of his everything that he's worked on. I mean, there are even shades of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban in some of these shots. It's just incredible. There's some shots reminiscent from Children of Men. And it's clear that working with Emmanuel Lubezki really, really did wonders for him. And, you know, obviously the guy has a great cinematic eye to begin with. But every shot, and it can't be stated enough, every single shot of this could be hung in a museum. It is just beautiful to look at, and it is just so packed with storytelling. The acting is brilliant. And again, considering that these are all unknowns and first-timers, that is just nothing short of a Christmas miracle in my book.
Oh, for sure. And I just think what's incredible about this film is it's just jam-packed with the types of sequences that you never see in films. Like we said, you know, while there may not be, you know, this, you know, narrative momentum that's pushing you forward, although there is that, it is there in some forms, but there's just these extended sort of almost standalone sequences where our characters that we followed throughout the story are just sort of in this other environment, and then they sort of have to react to the events that happen in this environment. And it just really, like I said, it's just not common across all the films we typically see. And I think that's what's great about Cuarón, is he's always pushing the limits, whether visually, you know, narratively, etc. He's clearly trying to express himself in a clear way, and that's the mark of a true artist. But I think with that in mind, we can transition into our last film of the day, which is Yorgos Lanthimos' The Favourite, which, you know, Yorgos' name is always a mouthful, and safe to say, he's made some films that are unique experiences, to say the least. A lot of people haven't seen Dogtooth, which you should definitely check out, although I'm not recommending it for all the audience. That's definitely more for the art house audience, to say the least. But getting to The Favourite, you know, I will admit that, you know, costume dramas and period pieces have never exactly been, you know, my forte. But if all period pieces were this foul mouth and sex crazed, it'd be my favorite genre. Because, you know, I was a big fan of this film, although I did have, you know, at the end, I do have some issues. But that's pretty typical of a Yorgos Lanthimos film where, you know, he takes you to a place and then he's always going to end it at a certain point. And I sort of know his instincts, so I wasn't entirely sort of taken off base with that. But, you know, the film is really, you know, about sort of the three central female performances. Emma Stone is cast perfectly. What's interesting, I knew a bit of the backstory about this where, you know, he certainly didn't intend to cast an American, but Emma Stone was really gung-ho about this role, so she fought for it and she got it. And you could see why it perfectly utilizes her snarky persona just almost to an even darker effect, which I think completely works. Rachel Weisz, who I've always found to be very underrated, I think she's really great in the film as sort of Emma Stone's opposition. And then, of course, we have Olivia Colman as the queen, who gives a very memorable performance and is certainly getting accolades that are certainly very deserving. But they sort of form this triforce isn't the right word, but you know, they sort of form this sort of central sort of conflict and dynamic that is entertaining to watch and play out. But I think what's so entertaining about the film is that, like I said, you know, it has elements in there that you don't normally see in all of these, and I expect it because Yorgos is always going to push the limits of what can be shown in this certain context. And I think, you know, just, you know, constant swearing, constant, you know, brazen sex, you know, and just acting like it's a normal part of the world, that's what I live for. So, you know, that's what I want to see, you know, and it definitely adds another layer of entertainment to this period piece. But I also did want to mention Nicholas Hoult, who feels like this film's secret weapon. You know, Nicholas Hoult, you know, a lot of you guys may not know him by name, but he played the Beast in all these X-Men films, among others. You know, he's in Warm Bodies, that zombie, underrated zombie movie. You know, I think he's really great here as this sort of, like, he's sort of this duplicitous, you know, part of the government, and he's sort of, like, using the queen's sort of emotions and sort of playing off it and utilizing Emma Stone in certain ways. But I just think he's really an underrated part of this film that isn't getting enough attention, because he has that role that is just sort of perfect to rile up these other characters, but he just works, and his interactions with all the characters, I think, are just always a joy to watch.
Yeah, Yorgos Lanthimos is a... So I'll start with Dogtooth, because I saw it when it first came out, and I was like, oh man, this movie is... brilliant, but it's a little too cynical for my blood. I also don't recommend it if you're a cat person either. I don't think that's a spoiler given away that something bad happens there. But even though I didn't see The Killing of a Sacred Deer last year, unfortunately, I did see The Lobster, and I wasn't as crazy about it as I was The Favorite. I like The Favorite quite a bit. Obviously, costume dramas are a tough sell for me too. This is more of a wacky costume comedy with that art house maniacal bent to it. It keeps things, Yorgos Lanthimos keeps things crazy enough to the point where, you know, it doesn't even feel like this particular iteration of the genre. It's just like nonstop insanity from the get-go. I mean, you see all these wealthy aristocrats racing ducks, for instance, and, there's rampant profanity. It's a lot less mannered. I mean, everyone is just kind of like, everyone's puking at certain points. It's wanton sex. And it's all very interesting and very entertaining, and the acting is fantastic. But, you know, like other Yorgos Lanthimos films, I'm left kind of a bit cold. At the end of it, I was left cold. And I don't know if disinterested is the right word, but maybe disengaged. So, obviously, I respect the craft of filmmaking. I mean, it's a beautiful film to look at. The period, the production is just absolutely phenomenal. There's such ornate detail in the costumes and in the, I mean, it should run away with best costume design and production design for my money. It's just beautiful to look at. Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, you know, as these dueling cousins, you know, Emma Stone trying to rise up the ranks of aristocracy to become Queen Anne's favorite, as it were. She's just so good in that, in the way she's so conniving, and she has how she's, putting up one front, but you see that little sliver of a crack showing that only the audience is supposed to get. And it's just, it's a lot of fun to watch her take on a role that's just so different than anything else she's ever done. Now, honestly, I think she's better in this than she was in La La Land, the movie she won the Oscar for. And she'll probably get nominated for this. But it's really the Olivia Colman show at the end of the day. I mean, she's just, she's such an insecure version of Queen Anne. But there's even like one shot where she's just kind of sitting there and watching Rachel Weisz and this other member of the opposition party, which is basically the Democrats of the time in this era, who are the anti-war party, who are doing this dance to kind of appease her. And you see her as she's watching this, but, you know, you see the joy very, very slowly drain out of her face. And then she just like completely flips out. It's just like such brilliant little, like, I'll call it micro acting, for lack of a better phrase. That's a horrible phrase, I'm so sorry, but it's just like little moments like that in her performance, those little ticks that really elevate what could have just been like a cheesy stock, you know, screaming at everyone to high heavens character. Rachel Weisz is Rachel Weisz. I mean, like you said, she's underrated. She was amazing in Disobedience earlier this year, and another great performance here. Nicholas Hoult as the the Chuck Schumer of this whole universe, if you will. A little bit of the backstory is that the country is at war, and the prime minister is just kind of rooting for more war. Nicholas Hoult is basically saying, don't raise taxes, the people hate it, there's no point in this, France is gonna be beaten anyway, we don't need to, you know. But he also has like this Machiavellian design where he kind of tries to recruit Emma Stone's character to be, you know, his eyes and ears within the throne room. But it's just so interesting that, like, even though you agree with what he's trying to do, it's just like so smarmy and gross, just like everyone else in the movie. So it's basically you're watching a bunch of really bad people stab each other in the back, and it's entertaining. It's a lot of fun. And it's funny. And that's something, I mean, there's still certainly dry parts. I mean, that's inherent to any costume drama period piece, but it's, and I we keep on calling it a drama. The movie's really a comedy. It's very funny, and it's tonally, I mean, yes, it's definitely a dark comedy. And even like I love the final, not getting too much into spoilers, but there's a nice juxtaposition with the editing as the very last shot of the film that we go into the credits, and appropriately enough go into Elton John's Skyline Pigeon as the closing song, which I thought was a very nice touch. Even if a bit anachronistic, I'm sure that's exactly what they were going for. But yeah, it's a very entertaining film, and it's very ornately made. Again, I feel cold coming out of it and disengaged, but that's just because, like I was saying with Roma and Spider-Man, I'm just a more hard-on-the-sleeve kind of guy, and I don't like, you know, we try to take the good and bad with people, but when all you're seeing is this, you know, conniving shittiness in people, yeah, it's a tiny bit off-putting.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something that I think Yorgos Lanthimos wants you to react in that way. Because it almost feels like, towards the end of his films, it almost feels like, you know, in a traditional movie, you know, it would go on for like another scene or two. But he always ends it just sort of a bit more. And I do think the last scene of this film, I definitely get his intention and I understand sort of what he's going for. But I think, you know, his intention is to leave the audience hanging a little bit and to make you think about what the hell you just experienced. And certainly if that was an intention, then a job well done. But I did want to mention, you know, Robbie Ryan's cinematography in this film. He's using very extreme wide angles, to say the least, you know, or for the layman, sometimes people call it, you know, the fisheye effect or whatever. But seem to say they're really extremely used in this case, which certainly adds a really interesting dynamic to the environment and sort of definitely sort of makes you feel as an audience member sort of off kilter a bit. And I think that definitely works to the intended effect in that way. I'm a big fan of his from his collaboration with one of my favorite filmmakers, Andrea Arnold. So it was just great to see him do something, although he's done certainly extreme type of stuff before. I've never seen him do this quite exactly the way he did it here, and I think it's really effective because of that. But yeah, I'm definitely a big fan of the film. Much like you, I do have a few reservations, but I think overall, I mean, it's definitely among my favorites of the year, although I have so many at this point, it's like gonna be really tough to get this list down to a top 10, to say the least. But if you don't have anything else to add, I guess we can transition into looking forward to next week, where we'll be checking out the latest Transformers film, Bumblebee, which I saw and I do recommend. Embrace the cheese, people, but we'll get to that next week. And also we're going to be checking out the latest DC film, Aquaman, which I'm sure we're going to have plenty of good takes on that film, to say the least.
And if you're searching for something to watch with your little butthole cousin this week and he likes horror movies, Hereditary will probably be popping up on Amazon Prime as a two-stream, I think, by the end of the week. So, you know, give him a look-see on that one. But as always, thank you so much for listening, and happy holidays and happy new year.